The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine, dated March 22, 2013. And as usual, we'll begin from the main story section here. Our first article is entitled, A New Era Begins with Pope Francis I. The cardinals of the Roman Catholic Church signaled their eagerness to open a new chapter this week by electing Jorge Mario Bergoglio, the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, as Pope, putting the world's 1.2 billion Catholics under the direction of a pontiff from the New World for the first time in Christianity's 2,000-year history. Bergoglio, 76, is also the first Jesuit to lead the Church and the first to take the name of Francis for the saint devoted to the poor. I would like to thank you for your embrace, said the 266th Pope as he spoke from the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica to thousands of faithful cheering below. After a prayer for his predecessor, Benedict XVI, the new Pope invited Catholics to pray for the entire world, adding, I hope that this path for the Church will be one fruitful for evangelization. Francis, who was born to Italian immigrant parents, is known as a humble man who led an austere life in Argentina. As Archbishop of Buenos Aires, he chose to stay in a simple downtown apartment rather than live in the church's ornate mansion, and rejected a chauffeur-driven limousine in favor of taking the bus to work. Bergoglio also won praise from moderates in the church for placing an emphasis on social justice and aid for the poor. He made headlines in 2009 when he chastised the Argentine government as immoral, illegitimate, and unjust for failing to tackle the country's soaring inequality. Francis, who finished second in all four rounds of balloting during the 2005 election of Benedict, is expected to set a new tone for a church battered by sex abuse scandals, corruption in the Vatican, and declining attendance at Mass. But he comes from the same conservative theological traditions as his predecessor and John Paul II, and staunchly opposes contraception, abortion, and same-sex marriage. Now here's what the columnist said. As a member of the famously liberal Jesuits, Bergoglio is an outsider, said Michael Potemra in NationalReview.com, and thus is a good choice to clean up the mess the church is currently in. It's no coincidence he chose the name Francis. Not only does it indicate a break in tradition, he's the first pope in over 1,000 years to choose an original name, but it is a clear tribute to St. Francis of Assisi, who was called by Jesus to rebuild the church. As the humble son of working-class parents, said Olga Kazin in TheAtlantic.com, Bergoglio will reach out to common people, exactly what the church needs in an age of dwindling congregations and a shrinking priesthood. But those hoping for a charismatic pope like John Paul II may be out of luck, said John Otis in TheHoustonChronicle.com. Bergoglio dislikes traveling and giving interviews and speaks quietly after losing a lung as a young man. His parishioners in Buenos Aires used to say they had to strain to hear his voice, and liberal Catholics will be disappointed by the new pope's doctrinal intransigence, said Eliza Shapiro in TheDailyBeast.com. He opposed Argentina's move to legalize same-sex marriage in 2010, calling it a destructive pretension against the plan of God. Bergoglio may be the basically conservative, said John L. Allen Jr. in the National Catholic Reporter, but he's not insensitive to pastoral realities. He has publicly criticized priests who refuse to baptize children born out of wedlock, and shown deep compassion to AIDS victims, even stooping to kiss and wash their feet. Despite all the hoopla, said Gary Wills in nybooks.com, the selection of a new pope means little. The role of the pontiff is becoming increasingly irrelevant, a historical relic of a hierarchical church no longer in touch with its followers. The idea of a man with a monopoly on God's word is an invention of medieval church leaders, and modern educated Catholics do not accept it. That's why so many of them pay no attention to papal fulminations on contraception, gay rights, artificial insemination, and women's equality. No matter what Francis I does, he will ultimately be both ordinary and ignorable. The next item from the main story section, Obama turns on the charm. What happened? President Obama has launched a charm offensive to repair his broken relations with the Republican Party, meeting and dining with congressional lawmakers in an attempt to negotiate a grand bargain of entitlement reform and revenue increases to reduce the deficit. Obama dined privately with 12 Republican senators last week before visiting Capitol Hill this week for separate meetings with Republicans and Democratic caucuses in both houses of Congress. It was his first meeting with House Republicans in 2 years. The president reportedly spoke with lawmakers about immigration, guns, and energy policies, but above all emphasized the need to work together to create a long-term budget plan to reduce deficit spending. Republicans welcomed the overtures, with Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma saying Obama was genuinely reaching out, and Senator John McCain saying the conversations could lead us to a grand bargain. But in an illustration of the wide ideological gulf between the two parties, Senate Democrats and House Republicans released separate 10-year budgets this week that took conflicting approaches to deficit reduction. A Republican budget written by Representative Paul Ryan aimed to balance the budget by 2023 by repealing the Affordable Care Act, turning Medicare into a voucher system, and cutting $4.6 trillion in spending, mostly in aid to the poor. Democrats, meanwhile, unveiled a plan to reduce deficits by cutting $975 billion in spending and closing $975 billion in tax loopholes over 10 years. The proposals have no chance of passing and were made as opening gambits for future negotiations. Now here's what the editorials had to say. Obama's outreach to Republicans was probably overdue, said the New York Times. Wining and dining members of Congress may counteract Obama's well-earned reputation for aloofness and will prove to Republicans he's willing to reform entitlements and cut spending if they'll consider raising new revenue. But presidential schmoozing can only go so far, said the Washington Post. The two parties have a substantive disagreement on what role tax increases and entitlement reform should play in reducing the deficit. This could be the last best opportunity to cut a deal before the 2014 election season kicks in. Count us as skeptical, said the Wall Street Journal. Obama's goal is still for Democrats to win the House in 2014 so he can govern without opposition. These meetings are likely just a tactical feint to convince the public he's willing to reach across the aisle. Republicans will know he's serious only if he puts real tax reform with lower overall rates and serious entitlement cuts on the table. Now here's what the columnist said. What's gotten into President Obama, said Ron Fournier in NationalJournal.com. It's not hard to figure out why he's suddenly wooing Republicans he previously scorned. Much of his political capital has vanished. His aides assumed the public would blame Republicans alone for the sequester cuts, but they were wrong. Obama's approval rating has dropped to 48%, and Americans are losing confidence in his leadership. That's why the White House is waving the white flag in its war with Congress, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Finally, Obama has learned that relying on demagoguery alone is a formula for failure. Despite the widespread cynicism in Washington, I'm optimistic, said Mark Halperin in Time.com. Obama knows time is running out for him to achieve a major deficit reduction deal that would cement his place in history, and Republican leaders really do appreciate the symbolism of being invited to the president's table. The elusive grand bargain is not just possible, but likely. Dream on, said Jim Vanderhey and Mike Allen in Politico.com. Obama blew his chance to get more tax revenue out of the Republicans when he accepted $600 billion to end the fiscal cliff standoff in December, a far cry from the $1.6 trillion he wants and the $1 trillion Republicans had discussed in previous grand bargain talks. Now House Republicans heading for the 2014 elections are terrified of having to explain not one, but two tax increases to conservative activists in their very conservative districts. A grand bargain may have been possible in December, but because of Obama's miscalculation, it's now a very long shot. Now from the main story section, we'll turn to the controversy of the week. Rand Paul, what did he achieve with his filibuster? It pains me to admit it, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, but Rand Paul was right. I had always dismissed the freshman GOP senator from Kentucky as an arch-conservative kook, but last week Paul staged a valuable 13-hour talking filibuster on the Senate floor, demanding that the Obama administration reveal whether it thinks it can order drone strikes against U.S. citizens on American soil. Perhaps it was a stunt by Paul to boost his national profile, but our country really needed a larger debate on presidential authority to order targeted assassinations. Paul provoked one by insisting that Attorney General Eric Holder clarify his earlier statement that the president could use drones domestically under extraordinary circumstances. Did that mean Paul asked in his filibuster that if the president gave the command, Americans could be killed in a cafe in San Francisco or in a restaurant in Houston? Holder responded, "The answer is no." Paul deserves due credit for getting an answer, said Jacob Sullum in Reason.com, but Holder's full response left plenty of wiggle room. The attorney general said that the president couldn't use drones to kill an American not engaged in combat on American soil. In other words, if the president deems an American to be an enemy combatant engaged in an act of terrorism here, yes, he could order that a predator vaporize him with a Hellfire missile. Why is that such a surprise? Asked the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. If enemy soldiers came ashore to attack the country, the commander-in-chief could obviously issue an order that they be bombed. Similarly, if U.S. citizens turned al-Qaeda leader Anwar al-Awlaki had been engaged in a terrorist act while hiding out in Virginia instead of Yemen, he too could be lawfully treated as an enemy soldier and killed. Paul muddied the established law by raising the absurd specter of the president using drones to kill college protesters and political dissidents. If Mr. Paul wants to be taken seriously, he needs to do more than pull political stunts that fire up impressionable libertarian kids in their college dorms. Paul's filibuster may have been theatrical, said Amy Davidson in NewYorker.com, but it was no mere stunt. He successfully embarrassed the Obama administration into finally giving some honest answers about its drone policy, thus showing why an angry libertarian can be so valuable. At the same time, said John Cass in the Chicago Tribune, Paul scrambled the usual political dividing lines, uniting libertarians, Tea Party conservatives, and liberals into a new constitutional coalition, alarmed by a war on terror that has no boundaries or limits. For the Republican Party, that could be an important turning point, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. It was startling to hear a Republican senator call for any limits whatsoever to a president's war-making powers, and even more startling that he was later praised for it by talk radio host Rush Limbaugh, as well as the other unofficial organs of the party who wield such influence over the Republican base. In time, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times, Paul's filibuster may be remembered as the moment the GOP started backing away from the hair-trigger hawkishness and absolute deference to executive power that characterized the Bush years. Paul has started a new intra-party debate, one that may finally drag the Republicans into the post-9/11 era. Now we'll turn to the popular column, Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4, from this week's edition of The Week magazine. It was a good week for chutzpah after lawyer Frederick Cohn asked a federal judge to bar Jews from the jury in the trial of his client on the grounds that they'd feel innate antipathy toward accused Islamist terrorist Abdi al-Hamid Shehadeh. The judge declined the request. It was a good week for dynasties after Jeb Bush's son, 36-year-old attorney George P. Bush, launched his political career by officially announcing he was running for Texas Land Commissioner. And it was a good week for America's new roving ambassador after Dennis Rodman, fresh from his summit with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, went to the Vatican in hopes of meeting the new pope. "I want to be anywhere in the world that I'm needed," Rodman explained. It was a bad week for returns after a Wisconsin man tried to bring back a faulty printer to Walmart, where store workers found the device jammed with a sheet of counterfeit $100 bills. Police were called and allegedly found another $300 in homemade money on Jared Carr, who is 37 years old. It was a bad week for Taylor Swift after hundreds of pieces of her fan mail were found unopened in a dumpster near her office in Nashville. A spokesman said that mail the singer's managers had intended to give her was accidentally put with letters headed for the recycling center. And it was a bad week for making a hole-in-one after an 18-foot sinkhole suddenly opened up beneath a golfer as he played the 14th hole at an Illinois fairway. Mark Mihal, who was pulled from the pit by friends, said the course was still one of his favorites, but admitted it'd be kind of strange playing that hole again. Now, from the Week magazine for this week, we'll turn to the briefing section. This week's article is entitled, Securing the Border. For immigration reform to proceed, Republicans say the Mexican border must be better protected. What would that take? How is the border defended now? Through a combination of fences and patrols, the Department of Homeland Security has fenced off 651 miles of the 1,969-mile border between the United States and Mexico. The barriers are mostly near urban areas and international bridges. The U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency uses patrols to guard the more remote borderlands in California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. The agency, currently larger than it's ever been, with over 58,000 personnel, spends $4 billion a year protecting the southwestern border with the help of 16,879 vehicles, 269 aircraft, 300 watercraft, and 300 camera towers. It even uses aerial drones to enhance the scrutiny. President Obama says that the U.S. has now strengthened border security beyond what many believed was possible. Senate Republicans, though, say they won't agree to immigration reform until the border is better protected. "We must follow through on the broken promises of the past to secure our borders and enforce our laws," said Senator Marco Rubio. How many illegal entrants are caught? In 2012, the Border Patrol apprehended about 357,000 people at the southwestern border, a 78% drop since 2000. The government points to the near-record lows in illegal migration as evidence of its success at deterring would-be immigrants from crossing illegally. Critics, though, say the decline is mostly a temporary function of the shortage of U.S. job opportunities. In a recent report, the Government Accountability Office estimated that only 61% of those attempting to cross the border illegally are interrupted, or rather are intercepted. Fewer than 100,000 annually are thought to have settled here in recent years. The GAO found that just 44% of the border was under operational control, with nearly two-thirds of the remaining 56% monitored and the rest low-level monitored. Critics say those numbers prove that security remains porous. The bottom line is that we are far from having operational control of our borders, said House Homeland Security Committee Chairman Michael McCaul, a Republican from Texas. How can security be improved? The Border Patrol could be deployed more efficiently. Currently, nearly 40% of the agency's staff is based in Tucson or El Paso, where intense enforcement has resulted in declining numbers of attempted crossings. San Diego has 80 Border Patrol pilots, while the entire Rio Grande Valley has just 15. To cover more remote areas, Republican lawmakers such as Michelle Bachmann and Ted Cruz have advocated erecting more fencing. Arizona has already committed to raising $50 million in private donations to completely fence off its 370-mile border with Mexico. It's not complicated, said conservative commentator Charles Krauthammer. Build the damn fence. Why hasn't that been done? Well, the cost and logistical challenges would be immense. Estimates from Customs and Border Protection suggest a cost of more than $22.4 billion to build a fence along the entire southwestern border, which runs along riverbanks and through remote deserts, marshlands, and hill country. On top of that would come ongoing maintenance costs. In 2010 alone, the agency repaired 4,037 breaches in the existing fences. The government would also need to expropriate private land, which would be both expensive and unpopular. And the border would still need policing, as illegal immigrants will try to breach, tunnel under, or climb over any fence. It's also possible, some immigration experts say, that ramping up border security could have unintended consequences. What would those be? Many illegal immigrants currently cross the border for seasonal work, then go back over to their families in Mexico. Additional border security could halt that ebb and flow, causing many illegal immigrants to choose to stay in the U.S. in perpetuity. Advocates of immigration reform argue that since our economy creates a big demand for the low-wage agricultural, factory, restaurant, and service labor that Mexicans provide, the best way to prevent illegal entrance is to create a realistic system that allows people to come and go on temporary work visas. It isn't possible to enforce our way out of our immigration problem, said Benjamin Johnson, executive director of the American Immigration Council. So what's likely to happen next? For reform to move forward, Congress, the White House, and the American people have to agree on what is an acceptable standard of border security. Past precedents suggest that will be difficult. The American Immigration Lawyers Association recently noted that all of the proposed security benchmarks outlined in 2006, 2007, and 2010 immigration bills have been met or exceeded, yet some lawmakers insist that border security remains insufficient. To truly close the border, as some demand, would require the equivalent of a 1969-mile Berlin Wall. The only nations that have come close to such control were totalitarian, with leaders who had no qualms about imposing border control and shoot-to-kill orders, said political scientist Ray Kozlowski of the State University of New York at Albany. as Republican and Democratic senators hammer out fresh immigration legislation, said El Paso Mayor John Cook. Their first question should be a basic one. How secure is secure? And now the footnote from this briefing article, paying to get across. Smuggling illegal aliens across the border is now a $6.6 billion industry for Mexican gangs. Rates range from $3,000 to $30,000 for transport across the border. And anyone who tries to cross without the paid assistance of the cartels that control various swaths of the border risks being beaten or shot. About 90% of illegal aliens now pay coyotes to sneak them across the border, and, according to the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service, as U.S. border security hardens, the gangs are devising ever more ingenious means of getting across. Smugglers have mocked up fake Halliburton trucks to cross through oil fields that straddled the Texas-Mexico border. They have also used stolen FedEx, UPS, and AT&T service trucks to ferry illegal immigrants into the United States. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for the week dated March 22, 2013. Thanks so much for joining me today. We'll now turn to the best columns in the U.S. according to The Week. Our first one is entitled Newtown's Very Limited Impact by Massimo Calabresi in Time.com. Despite all the outrage that followed December's Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre, said Massimo Calabresi, that tragedy may ultimately make almost no difference in federal gun control laws. Four pieces of legislation have emerged from weeks of negotiation, and only one is highly likely to become law. It makes straw purchasing and trafficking of guns a felony with tough penalties. Republicans support it mainly because it would allow the kind of proxy gun buying involved in the Justice Department's Fast and Furious scheme. Meanwhile, a ban on assault weapons is already near death, and so is the ban on large-capacity magazines. Most Republicans won't vote for these bans, and neither will Democrats from rural states. A proposed law to require background checks for all gun purchases, which would close the gun show loophole, still has a chance, but only if it includes a Republican demand that the government be forbidden to keep records of gun purchases. So here's the hard truth. Like Columbine, Aurora, and all the gun massacres before it, Newtown is fading into history, with little impact on our nation's gun culture. The next column is entitled The Baggage Jeb Bush Would Carry by Peter Boehnert in TheDailyBeast.com. Jeb Bush will never be president, said Peter Boehnert. The former Florida governor made the rounds of Sunday talk shows this past week, ostensibly promoting his new book on immigration, but at the same time obviously auditioning for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination. Asked if he would carry Bush baggage if he chose to run, Jeb said no. History will be kind to George W. Bush, he insisted. Sorry, Jeb, but history is written by historians, and they consistently rank your older brother as one of America's worst presidents, in the same tarnished category as Millard Fillmore and Warren Harding. The public agrees. In polls, only Richard Nixon is less popular. No wonder, given that W. turned a budget surplus into a $1.3 trillion deficit, presided over the worst financial collapse since the Great Depression, and badly botched the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. If Jeb ran in 2016, opponents would try to tie him to his brother. As Jeb made clear this week, he would find it excruciatingly hard to distance himself. In fact, he doesn't even want to try. And our third column is entitled Why Green Cars Aren't Really Green by Bjorn Lomborg in the Wall Street Journal. Electric cars have a dirty little secret, said Bjorn Lomborg. They're not as green as their owners would like to believe. Before an electric car leaves the showroom, it has produced 30,000 pounds of carbon dioxide, mostly in lithium battery production, about 16,000 pounds more CO2 than a conventional car. Electrics need recharging, of course, using electricity powered overwhelmingly by fossil fuels. So as owners cruise about feeling virtuous, they're indirectly emitting about 6 ounces of carbon dioxide per mile, about half as much as a gas-powered car. To emit less overall CO2, the electric car must be driven at least 80,000 miles. But because electrics need frequent recharging, their owners tend to use them only for short distances. So most electric car owners don't rack up that much mileage. Even if they did, an electric driven 90,000 miles would emit only 8.7 tons less carbon dioxide than a conventional car. On the European emissions market, credit for 8.7 tons of CO2 costs a mere $48. Here's the bottom line. Someday the electric car may replace gas vehicles, but as a way to tackle global warming now, it does nothing. And now it's time to flip to the back of the week magazine for this particular week, and we'll turn to The Last Word. This week, the article is entitled, What It Means to Be a Brother. The birth order of brothers, says George Howe Colt, is just one of the things that cause them to be so different. History is full of brothers, so different that it seems impossible they could have the same parents. A brief sampling through the ages might include the Arouets. Armand was a sanctimonious evangelical Catholic. His brother François-Marie, better known by his pen name Voltaire, was a witty, irreverent satirist and a savage critic of the Catholic Church. The Melvilles. Gainsbourg became a dutiful, responsible lawyer. His younger brother Herman became a world traveler and iconoclastic writer known to his family as the Runaway Brother. And the Carters. Sober and pious Jimmy became president, his younger brother Billy playing the court jester and drunken buffoon. How can siblings who share so much genetically and environmentally be so different? For many years, social scientists assume that a family affects the children within it almost identically, and that siblings raised under the same roof by the same parents tend to be far more similar than not. But over the past three decades, studies of intelligence, personality, interests, attitudes, and psychopathology have concluded that siblings raised in the same family are in fact almost as different from each other as unrelated people raised in separate families. The answer to sibling difference is in part genetic. Biological siblings share, on average, half their genes. If personality traits were entirely genetic, siblings would be 50% similar as well as 50% different, even before factoring in the effects of being raised in the same family by the same parents. But biological siblings have personality correlations of about 15%. Even identical twins have only about a 50% overlap. Although siblings share about half of each other's genes, not only is the genetic contribution of each parent halved, but the sequence of those shared genes is rearranged through a process called recombination. The behavioral geneticist David Lykin has observed that, genetically speaking, siblings are like people who receive telephone numbers with the same digits arranged in a different sequence. Just as those telephone numbers, when dialed, will result in entirely different connections, genes that have been scrambled will express themselves in widely different personalities. But this is only part of the puzzle. A growing amount of research suggests that siblings may be influenced most strongly by the things they don't share: birth order, age, friends, teachers, and the vagaries of chance. And they don't even really share the things that appear to have in common. If not identical genes, then seemingly identical parents, homes, and often schools, because each of them perceives those things differently. Psychologists say that the experience of each child within a family is so distinct that each shows up in his own unique microenvironment. In effect, each sibling grows up in a different family. The notion that parents should treat their children equally is relatively new, and treating each child according to his own or her own needs is a natural and unavoidable situation. A restive infant demands more attention than one who sleeps through the night. A rambunctious toddler more than her independent 6-year-old brother. A sick child more than a healthy one. But the line between differential and preferential treatment can be thin. Even the most well-meaning, Spock-indoctrinated parent may be unconsciously drawn to the child who is higher achieving, less demanding, or more affectionate. The way a parent reacts to a child depends, of course, on that parent's own upbringing and temperament. This may also depend on whether the pregnancy was wanted or unwanted, planned or unplanned. After the birth of their first child, John Cheever's aging, quarrelsome parents had no desire to have a second, a fact they went out of their way to let him know. "If I hadn't drunk 2 Manhattans one afternoon," his mother told him, "you never would have been conceived." Cheever's parents treated their second-born as little more than an appendage to their beloved first, which surely contributed to his lifelong need to be desired. As a friend observed after Cheever's death, "If there's someone who never loved himself, it was John." Anecdotal evidence suggests that favoritism can have enduring consequences. A man who has been the indisputable favorite of his mother keeps for life the feeling of a conqueror, that confidence of success that often induces real success, wrote Freud, whose parents treated him like a hothouse flower at the expense of his 6 younger siblings, cultivating a sense of entitlement that he would flex for the rest of his life. Freud, whose mother called him "my golden Siggy," didn't bother to discuss the effects of favoritism on the non-favored child. Being the parental favorite, however, may be a mixed blessing. The preferred child may earn the envy or even the enmity of his siblings. He may grow up assuming that the world owes him a living. A Hong Kong study found a higher incidence of low self-esteem and suicidal ideation in adolescents who believe their parents played favorites. Surprisingly, the higher rate held true for both the favored and the non-favored child. In a 1937 paper, the psychologist Alfred Adler suggested that birth order has psychological ramifications as well. Adler declared that the firstborn child, having been dethroned by the arrival of a brother or sister, struggles to maintain his dominant status and is likely to become a kind of surrogate parent who cleaves to law and order. "The second-born child," said Adler, "behaves as if he were in a race, as if someone were a step or two in front and he had to hurry to get ahead of him. He is under full steam all the time. He trains continually to surpass his older brother and conquer him. Unthreatened by the possibility of dethronement, the last-born tends to be spoiled. Overshadowed by elder siblings, however, he may develop an inferiority complex. In keeping with the truism that psychologists tend to devise theories that reflect their personal circumstances, Adler was a second-born who struggled all his life to surpass his elder brother. Subsequent research has refined and expanded on Adler's observations. Born into a hothouse environment in which they enjoyed undivided parental attention, firstborns tend to be precocious achievers. They walk and talk earlier than later borns. They have higher IQs, 3 points higher on average, than that of their next eldest sibling, according to a 2007 study. They have been described as assertive, ambitious, conscientious, responsible, organized, and self-reliant. Not only scientists, but American presidents, British prime ministers, members of Congress, Rhodes Scholars, Ivy League students, Nobel Prize winners, MBAs, CEOs, surgeons, pilots, and professors are more likely to be firstborns. Of the first 23 American astronauts in space, 21 were firstborns, and the other two were only children. Only children being considered by birth order theorists to be a kind of uber eldest. Firstborn sons are encouraged to be role models. They're expected to act as substitute parents. You must not reckon yourself only their brother, the Prince of Wales told the 10-year-old future King George III in 1749, but I hope you will be a kind father to them. George tried, but his 8 siblings, an unusually profligate and promiscuous lot, proved to be no less difficult to control than the 13 colonies. They are expected to be babysitters, nursemaids, and nannies. Benjamin Spock, who grew up feeding, changing, and rocking to sleep his 5 younger siblings, would, as the author of best-selling baby care books, become a pediatrician parent to a nation. The second-born child, unable to compete physically with his larger, stronger brother, learns to work things out with words. Second-borns tend to be mediators, compromisers, peacemakers. They are often described as cooperative, sociable, empathetic, flexible, agreeable. Second-borns may also become fiercely competitive as they struggle to keep pace with their older siblings. Yet the second-born sibling may feel that no matter what he does, his older brother has done it before him. Henry James wrote that his brother William had gained such an advance of me in his 16 months' experience of the world before mine began that I never for all the time of childhood and youth in the least caught up with him or overtook him. The second-born's defense of being second best may be reinforced by parents. The Duchess of Marlborough famously referred to her 2 sons as the heir and the spare. If firstborns often are the achievers and middle children the peacemakers, lastborns are the entertainers and spotlight seekers. Some of history's greatest satirists, Swift, Voltaire, Franklin, Twain, were born at or near the tail end of large families, and many of their spiritual heirs, 20th century comedians like Charlie Chaplin, Oliver Hardy, Danny Kaye, Mel Brooks, Jim Carrey, Eddie Murphy, and Steve Martin, are last borns. Stephen Colbert is the 11th of 11. Lastborns are also more likely to be pranksters and risk-takers. They are overrepresented among the ranks of explorers, entrepreneurs, firemen, and fighter pilots. Lastborns are said to be charming, affectionate, spontaneous, mischievous, and because the baby of the family tends to get infantilized, pampered, temperamental, irresponsible, and manipulative. The 19th century polymath Francis Galton championed the importance of heredity in shaping one's life, but he also noted that the whimsical effects of chance often play a vital role. Siblings may share family milestones, a move, parental job loss, parental depression, the illness or death of a parent, but they may experience them very differently according to a personality or developmental stage. For John Adams' 3 sons, timing was everything. In 1778, when Adams was appointed by Congress to argue the American cause in Europe, he took along 10-year-old John Quincy. Too young for the journey, 7-year-old Charles and 5-year-old Thomas remained with their mother Abigail on the family farm. John Quincy would spend 7 years abroad with his father, traveling from capital to capital, hobnobbing with Jefferson, Franklin, Lafayette, and a host of European intellectuals, serving at the age of 14 as secretary to the American envoy in St. Petersburg, taking 5-mile walks each morning before work with his father, who was grooming the child he called the joy of my heart for greatness. Meanwhile, his younger brothers worked at their lessons, did their chores, and submitted to their domineering mother. When Abigail joined her husband and eldest son in Europe, leaving her younger sons in her sister's care, Charles and Thomas were entirely parentless for 2 years. Given such curricula vitae, it was perhaps not surprising that John Quincy Adams became, among other things, a U.S. senator, Harvard professor, minister to Great Britain, Secretary of State, and president. Or that genial but feckless Charles spent more time drinking than studying at college, struggled to establish a law practice, squandered the $2,000 his older brother left him in trust, abandoned his wife and two small daughters, and died alcoholic and broke at the age of 30. Or that Thomas, unable to sustain a legal practice, served a year in the state legislature before quitting abruptly to become a drinker and gambler who failed to provide for his wife and 7 children. Described by a nephew as one of the most unpleasant characters in this world, Thomas died also alcoholic and broke at the age of 59. And that article was from Brothers by George Howe Colt, reprinted by permission of Scribner, a division of Simon & Schuster. Now, from the last word, we'll turn to the Health and Science section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first article is entitled, A Newborn Cured of HIV. Doctors in Mississippi appear to have cured a baby girl of an HIV infection, a breakthrough that researchers hope to replicate for the sake of other infected children. Within 30 hours of being born in a rural hospital, the infant tested positive for the virus, and doctors immediately began treating her with an aggressive regimen of conventional antiretroviral drugs. Infected babies typically have to take such drugs indefinitely to keep the virus in check. But after 18 months, the mother disappeared with her daughter and stopped giving her the medicine. The doctors located the girl again several months later and, fearing the worst, ordered up ultra-sensitive blood tests. When all those came back negative, I knew something odd was afoot, Hannah Gay, the child's pediatrician, told NPR.org. Catherine Lazuriaga, a pediatric AIDS expert at the University of Massachusetts, thinks Gay's early and aggressive treatment curtailed the formation of viral reservoirs in the girl's body. The girl, now 2 years old and a half year, 2.5 years old, rather, is only the second person known to have been cured of the disease. The other was an adult male who received a bone marrow transplant from an HIV-resistant donor. Worldwide, some 300,000 HIV-positive babies are born every year. The next article from Health and Science section here is Why Pessimists Live Longer. Developing a negative outlook may be the secret to living a longer, if not happier, life. A German study found that the more people underestimated their future life satisfaction, the less likely they were to die early or become disabled. The AARP.org reports, researchers asked 40,000 people between the ages of 18 and 96 to rate how happy they thought they'd be in 5 years on a scale of 0 to 10. Then, 5 years later, they checked to see how they felt. They found that for every point by which a person had overestimated his or her future well-being, there was a 10% higher likelihood of death or disability in the following decade. Pessimism about the future may encourage people to live more carefully, taking health and safety precautions. The study authors write, surprisingly enough, people who were healthy and wealthy were more likely to expect the worst and thus survive in better shape than were people who had low incomes and poor health. People over 65 were the most likely to underestimate their future happiness, while people under 40 were the most unrealistically optimistic. And the next article is the health scare of the week, anorexic kindergartners. Doctors are diagnosing more and more children as young as age 5 with anorexia nervosa, ABCNews.com reports. Hospitalizations of elementary school children with a potentially deadly eating disorder, which causes them to starve themselves, increased by 72% between 1999 and 2009. No one knows what triggers it, says Julie O'Toole, a pediatrician who directs an eating disorders clinic. The science isn't there yet. She says it doesn't appear to be brought on by the media or by pressure to be thin, but is largely heritable and often accompanied by an anxiety disorder. Anorexia is diagnosed 10 times more often among girls than among boys, but it may be that boys are just better at hiding their symptoms. O'Toole says, researchers say, the disorder can be particularly difficult to spot in children under 12, who may stop eating without being able to articulate the reason. Diagnosing children quickly is critical, says Lynn Greffey, director of the National Eating Disorders Association, because the longer the person has an eating disorder, the harder the recovery. Now we'll turn to the Talking Points section of the Week magazine. Our first article is entitled, Iraq, 10 years on, were the radicals right? About 10 years ago, as the U.S. prepared to invade Iraq, I covered an anti-war rally in New York City, said Rod Dreher, the AmericanConservative.com. I found the crowd to be a disgusting bunch with their mindless anti-war slogans, their stupid drum circles, and their hateful Bush equals Hitler posters. The protesters actually made me feel more secure in the rightness of the war, because how could such radicals be right and everyone else, including the president, Congress, and the majority of the public, be wrong? Today, with the anniversary of the invasion upon us, I have to admit that the chanting protesters had it right after all. Launched in a fit of post-9/11 fear and hysteria, the Iraq War proved to be a tragic and needless 9-year-long adventure that cost more than $1 trillion, saw 37,000 of our troops killed or wounded, and took the lives of at least 100,000 Iraqi civilians. Those protesters deserve no retroactive applause, said Nick Cohen in Guardian.com.uk. When they took to the streets, those supposed progressives were, in effect, defending the regime of Saddam Hussein, a savage dictator who tortured and killed tens of thousands of Iraqis and tried to exterminate Iraqi's Kurdish minority in true Hitlerian fashion with poison gas. Yes, the U.S. failed to understand the depth of Sunni-Shiite hatred and botched its attempt to stabilize post-invasion Iraq. But the liberal case for freeing Iraqis from Saddam's brutal oppression is as solid now as it was in 2003, and the liberal refusal to acknowledge it no less mystifying. That isn't why we invaded Iraq, though, said Conor Friedersdorf in the Atlantic.com. The Bush administration insisted falsely that Saddam was hiding weapons of mass destruction, while the neoconservatives who pushed the war saw it as a way to install a democratic government in the Middle East and show Muslims how dangerous it was to mess with the U.S. In 2002, conservative pundit Jonah Goldberg banged his drum for the war by quoting neocon Michael Leadon, "Every 10 years or so, the U.S. needs to pick up some crappy little country and throw it up against the wall, just to show the world we mean business." If the term radical applies to anyone, it's surely those who caused so much human suffering on some amoral grounds. The next article, airport security. Knives, yes. Shampoo, no. It's still too dangerous to let passengers take a water bottle on a flight, said Newsday in an editorial. But if you have a small knife, a golf club, or a hockey stick that you want to carry onto the plane, that's just fine. Under new rules announced by the U.S. Transportation Security Administration last week, passengers can carry pocket knives and sports equipment when they board planes, a decision that's baffling a nation. The government says that freeing up TSA inspectors to stop searching for small pocket knives, screwdrivers, and other implements will make security lines shorter. Even for the often mocked TSA, this is madness. Small blades can do plenty of damage, as hijackers with box cutters proved on September 11, 2001. And why allow knives in the cabins when they're still taking off our shoes, submitting to full body scans, and measuring our shampoo bottles? Now we'll take a look at a few shorter items from the Talking Points section as we move towards the end of our program for this week. Despite reports of surging gun sales, the proportion of U.S. households in which a gun is present has fallen from about 50% in the 1970s to 34% last year, according to the General Social Survey. The decline in household gun ownership over that period has been most marked among those under 30, where it has dropped from 47% to 23%. The poorest 25% of Americans spend 16% of their income on food, while the wealthiest 25% spend just 11.6%. The wealthiest, however, spend five times as much money as the poorest on dining out. The sale of horse meat in France has jumped about 15% in recent weeks as news about horse being found in frozen prepared meals rekindles interest among French men and women who ate horse in their childhoods. There are about 700 remaining horse butcher shops in France. Up to 6,000 patients a year leave the U.S. operating rooms with surgical sponges, forceps, and other surgical tools mistakenly left inside them. The error is usually not detected until the patient develops a life-threatening infection. And every day around the world, some 39,000 girls under the age of 18 are forced into marriage, with their families often selling them off for dowries, often to much older men. And now we'll look at the poll watch for this week. 52% of American Catholics think the church is out of touch with them. 62% want the next pope to change the church's stance on celibacy for priests and the ordination of women. And 64% want the ban on contraception lifted. 81% want the next pope to do more to combat sexual abuse. And we've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next week. I certainly hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.